It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Yeah, actually, on Tuesday, I got the new COVID booster and the flu shot, and it pretty much fucked me up yesterday.
Oh, no.
I had to cancel all my plans. I feel fine now, but... So, okay. I'm not too ashamed to admit this, and maybe it's true for a lot of people who are not good at keeping a clean house. Until I retired and became a full-time homemaker, there were a lot of basic cleaning things about our house that if you'd like, when the last time you did it, if you're lucky, the answer would have been like several months ago. And with a lot of them, it would have been like years ago. Things like vacuuming, mopping. It literally was years since those things have been done. But now all of that shit is happening on a regular basis. And that's great. So we go through a lot more cleaning products now.
Yeah.
And you can tell, like, Trish will come home and she'll be like, oh, you mopped today, because she knows what the mop cleanser smells like. Or she'll go in the bathroom and be like, oh, yeah, you clearly cleaned it. A, I can tell because there's less cat hair and there aren't spots on the mirror, but also it smells like the bleach cleaner and stuff like that. She really likes these smells because it smells clean to her. Is that how is your experience with those things? What do you associate that sort of smell with?
I don't know. You know, I worked in a hospital as a janitor and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So some of my, I think that affects, like, I can kind of put, you know, sort of mentally send myself back in time to when, you know, my mom would clean things and, you know, she would use stuff that smelled like pine and, you know,
yeah,
in her cleaning. And I remember liking that or thinking that was nice. I also remember going to hospitals and stuff and the hospital smelled a certain way. I don't know what it smelled like. It smelled clean though. It seemed like a clean smell to me, which I remember people complaining about the hospital smell, and I always thought it was actually
that does the nice sterileness, as a lot of people say. Yeah.
I always thought it was kind of pleasant. But working in a hospital and working with a lot of chemicals that all smell different, and none of them smelled like pine, and none of them smelled like I remember hospitals smelling. You know, that wasn't an unpleasant experience, but I wouldn't say it was a pleasant experience either. So yeah. I think for the most part, you know, whenever I go into a place and into our home or any place that I can smell the chemicals and I know, oh, this has been cleaned recently or they did the floors recently or whatever. I don't think it really has any particular effect. Although when Abby uses, I guess I've used the pine stuff sometimes. I don't usually use things that smell like pine.
And if it's a sense memory thing, that's huge. No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's still a thing. But I smell pine in here. And even if she puts it like in an air freshener or in a diffuser or something, I always have like a kind of a nostalgic, you know.
My biggest sense memory is Aqua Velva Ice Blue, which was the aftershave my father wore. And the reason it's so big is there was a tradition that ran for a very long chunk of my childhood where they had a ensuite bathroom to the master bedroom, obviously, that was the one just they used. And so in the morning I could hear him shaving because he had an electric razor. And then afterwards he would put that on. And there was the thing where when I would hear it turn off, I would run in there and he was putting on aftershave, and he would take the thing and he'd just do that and he'd boop it on my nose and it would smell really strong. And it wasn't until my 30s or something that somebody was wearing it or whatever, and I smelled it and it's just like, dad, like in my face.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are things like that for me too.
But clean, and maybe this means my family didn't clean that well, I don't know. I don't like the smell. Oh, sorry. My screen was suddenly covered with the last meeting. Because it just finished converting. I don't like the smell. And it always, in my head, smells dirty somehow. The cleaning product smelled dirty. And it sort of doesn't matter which cleaning product it is. And originally, I kind of assumed, because everything was very dirty in my house, that I was cleaning it and it was cleaner, but it was also getting wet, the remaining dirt. Because, you know, everything wasn't perfectly spick and span the first time I did it. There's stuff that is like, you know, I mopped and that part's still not there. And then as I did it repeatedly, it eventually sort of got clean and now it's very clean. And so I thought that was what it, but now it's been going on for a while. And I'm still trying to figure it out, because in my head, just today, I was like, does the smell of cleaner make me think it recently was cleaned, which therefore means it was slightly less recently dirty?
Well, there are a couple.
But weirdly, the smell of cleanser makes me think of things being not clean.
There are a couple cleaner smells that don't make me think of cleanliness. One of them is bleach, which that might be related to
when a lot of the stuff I use in the bathroom has got bleach in it.
When I worked in food service, we would have a pan of cold bleach water, cold because if it was warm water or hot water, the bleach would evaporate. So you have cold bleach water, and the bleach water itself didn't, you know, stay clean. I mean, you had to change it. Some people didn't, whatever. So that might be part of that. But also any cleaner that's like ammonia based, and I could smell ammonia, that also doesn't make me think clean. It doesn't make me think dirty, but it doesn't make me think of a clean surface.
In the kitchen, I use Pine Sol, but I use lemon scented Pine Sol. I don't even think you can get pine scented Pine Sol anymore, which makes the name ridiculous. But I use lemon scented, which I think I like, because like dish soap, I like the smell of lemon, and in general, I like the smell of dish soap. But for some reason, like when I mopped the kitchen just the other day, and she was like, "Oh, it smells nice," and I was like, "No, I don't like the smell." And what's more, it doesn't smell clean to me. It kind of smells the opposite, and I don't know what that's about. But we ain't got time to talk about that, because we had so much shit we didn't talk about last time. Hi there, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast that when we do a two-parter, it really is like, just we just did one big podcast. So like, think of the first hour that you heard a week ago as the intro, and now we're gonna do the actual podcast, even though that's not how it should work or anything. I'm Tony,
and I'm William, and this is episode 602.
All right. And we are not going to discuss how the show works. If you're hearing it for the first time, go to the previous episode, or really go back further, but previous episode at least, and you deal with that crap.
Oh, you know what? I forgot last time to wish everybody a happy equinox, because it's the equinox as we're recording this.
Oh, yeah.
That was last week now. Forgot. Oh, well.
If you didn't have a happy one, it's William's fault.
It's my fault. For not wishing you a happy
equinox. He didn't wish you soon enough. And if you have time travel, go back a week now. Have a happy.
You said you were going to talk about video games. That's what you said.
I was. I'm going to talk about some other things, but I want to talk about a video game.
Okay.
Because I was surprised by this video game. I'm mostly still playing a lot of Final Fantasy 14. Still like it a lot. But sometimes they have to do maintenance. And because a lot of it is based in Asia and they do it across all of the data centers at the same time, they don't choose the real useful off hours in my time zone.
Yeah, right.
So frequently when they're doing maintenance, it's basically starting around 5 o'clock my time.
Right when you want
until way wee hours of the morning. And so there are some nights where if I'm not doing stuff with Trish, I would normally play Final Fantasy. I'm like, well, shit, what am I going to do? So I will grab other games, and I am a PlayStation Plus member. And so I have a shit ton of free games that I got from that, and I'll grab those. And I recently grabbed one and I installed it, and then I didn't play it for a long time. And I finally decided to try it out, called Slay the Spire. And I've since found it's apparently quite a popular game. You can get it for PC for like $25, but I have it on PS4. And I'm weirdly getting a little addicted to it. And it's a very simple indie game. And it actually reminds me a great deal of a game I got on my tablet one time for like $3 in terms of gameplay style. And what it is, in the parlance, is a turn-based card battle rogue like. And apparently that's my jam. Apparently I really like turn-based card battle roguelikes.
I'm not sure what all that means. Turn-based, right? I think I understand. Card
turn-based means in no way are my reflexes being tested. There's none of this, oh, jump over this, move up. No, it's just a thing where it's like, oh, what do you want to do now? And I can take a half hour to decide if I want it.
But then you have to wait for them to do whatever they're going to do.
Yeah, but it's a computer, so it'll take them like 3 seconds. And they're like, okay, they did this. And, you know, so it's more like, say, like a board game or something. You're playing with another person. It's my turn. I do the thing. It's their turn. I do the thing. Rather than, you know, ones where it's like you're in real time doing stuff and hand-eye coordination and rhythm and stuff are part of it, which I don't always hate, but I find stressful, and B, as I get older, I'm worse and worse at, and C, I was never that great to begin with. Turn-based, depending on how it's done in a game, can get boring for me nowadays, but this is not the case here. Card battle means everything involved is done with cards, and I have a deck of cards, and I draw 5 cards, and like if I play this card, I hit them with an attack. If I play this card, I put up a defense. If I play this card, I do some wacky crazy thing that does cool stuff, or I put a status effect on them, or things like that. And the roguelike is the part I know the least about, but it basically is you iterate a lot. You're going to go through the same things and you're going to die. Or in this case, you can sometimes get to the end and beat it. It's not very long, but the whole point, then you're done. And the whole point is you play again and again. And over time you unlock new features and things like that and learn from it and improve. But you're doing a lot of playing it and your character died. And then you basically have to start from scratch over again, but at that point you've unlocked new features that can show up and things like that. And it's a very basic fantasy thing. The basic idea is there's a big tower and you're a dude or lady or person or robot in one case going up each floor, and on each floor most of the time it's the monsters. You attack the monsters and you try not to die. But on some floors, oh, it's a person who will sell you stuff. On other floors, oh, there's a weird choose your own adventure moment where, like, you see this thing. Do you want to fuck with it or do you want to leave it or things like that? Or, you know, then sometimes there's a boss fight. And sometimes there's a little campfire and you can rest up or whatever, that kind of thing. And there are 4 character classes and you start off with just one and then you slowly can like unlock them as you do better. And they all have things that unlock. And so there are new abilities and stuff. There's the cards. And then there's something called relics, which are just little things you get that are up in the corner that do weird things. And then there's something called potions that temporarily do weird things. So just like for one fight, you drink a potion and something happens or whatever. And these all, and then there's monsters, and monsters have different abilities and different combinations and things like that. And there's lots of statuses and stuff. And so all of these together create so many combinations that the replayability is pretty strong. And like to the degree where I'm playing it and I'm like, oh, I have a chance to get this card. Yeah, I'm going to get this card because it's really been good before. And then I'm going on and I'm like, oh, wait, but the way I'm playing it this time is like this. And so this card isn't actually as useful this time. And then the next time I play, I'm like, actually, if I do this, this, and this, that's a great combination of things. But like, but you get your cards are random and the relics are random and things like it's not on the third floor. You always get this one. There's a lot of randomization involved. And in fact, even like the bosses, like there's a bunch of different bosses and you'll get a particular level of boss when you hit that point, but it's not going to be the same one. And they have different powers and different weaknesses and stuff. And it's very sort of indie. It's very two-dimensional. You're over here, the bad guys are over here thing. And there's minimal animation and it's pretty static backgrounds. It's a very sort of hand-drawn arty style to it. But it's just really compelling and I really enjoy it. And you can save pretty much anywhere. So it's really good of like, I got 10 minutes. Let's do a couple of fights or whatever.
And you called it
pretty fun.
Roguelike? Is that what you said?
Roguelike. That years and years and years and years and years ago, there was a game called Rogue that was a fighting dungeon crawler thing. And this was back in like the DOS days. And if you died, you had to just start over. Like there was no, like the whole game, you had to start over. And so that's a genre of game now. But there are roguelikes and one's called roguelite. And I don't know the difference. But the basic premise is you don't like start from your most recent save or something or have lives. If you die, you go back to the beginning. And essentially start over. And then a lot of them are a little more gentle where you start over, but like this one type of currency or this one type of ability stays at its new level. Or in some cases, I've heard of ones where you die and like essentially the next generation starts again and they have like inherited a trait from your character based on whatever the stats were of that character.
So like is Dark Souls one of these where you die and you have to start over?
No, Dark Souls is just fucking hard is what that is. I mean, Dark Souls actually has save points. Bonfires are like save points. Hades was a very popular game recently that is a roguelike. I'm trying to think of other good. I mean, it's a little bit more old school arcade where it's just like, yeah, you just gotta start over again. And the point isn't to beat it. Because technically, I started this game the very first time. I beat it. There's only three sets of floors. I mean, and each set is like 15 or 20 floors. But it's only like three sets. And I got to the end.
Huh.
And then it's like, you want to start again? I haven't managed it since then. And sometimes I've died very quickly because there's a lot of it's just a really good combination. There's a lot of randomization and a lot of tactics and strategy involved. So it really hits that easy to learn, difficult to master sweet spot. And the characters are very different in a lot of ways. The first character is a real basic fighting dude. And then I get one that involves a lot of poison and daggers and things, and I get different kinds of cards for that. And then the next one I unlocked is this fucking robot who has these orbs that I can channel or put things in, and like they do different things when they're floating around me, and if I use them they go away, but they do even a different thing. And that combines with, again, I have cards that do other stuff at the same time. And then the last one is a sort of monk thing that has different stances and that affects how she attacks or how people attack her and things like that. And they're just all very different. And then again, I've had relics that like drastically change the game. I've had relics. A lot of relics are like, you get this cool thing, but also this thing sucks. Mm-hmm. And also at the beginning, I don't really understand it, but whenever you start again, this big whale is there and he's like, hey, here are some essentially buffs. You pick one of these to start with. And again, some of them are just like a cool thing, but a lot of them are like, get rid of this thing and you can have this other cool thing. But again, there's a lot of randomization involved. And yeah, I mean, I can see a point where I'm going to be tired of it. But right now, there's just a lot. And it's, I don't play games for challenge. We've made a big point of that. There is something about feeling a sense of progress, and also something about feeling like you get it better. So like I play the game as this character, and the next time I'm like, you know, I'm really doing better at this because I really have a sense of how this works. Or I try, like there are times, because frequently at the end of a fight, you get to pick a new card and there's like three to pick from. And there are times where I've been like, that's the card that's going to help most for what I'm doing. I want that card. But there's other times like I'm like, I haven't seen that card. That's bizarre. I'm going to take that card, even though it doesn't look as helpful, just because I want to see what it does. Yeah. And like how I can fit that into potential strategies and stuff. Right. And it's just a real fun. There's almost a puzzle aspect to it. And it's very simple and it's very fast paced. But again, I can pause and I do. And the game is actually really good at moving the cursor around the screen. And like you put it on you or you put it on a monster. And there's all the little status things that have all these symbols. It just lists like all of them and what they mean. And like if you see a card and it's like you get three energy when you like next to the card, it'll be like energy is this and this. And so it's really good at making sure you know what's happening. And I'm really enjoying it. So I just wanted to tell people about it. I believe it's like $25 on Steam if you play on a PC. I don't know what it is on console. But again, if you've been doing PlayStation Plus for a while, you probably have it for free. And I would recommend checking it out because it's very cool.
Did you like strategy board games when you were a kid? Like Risk and stuff like that, Stratego?
I don't think I did, but because I don't tend to enjoy competition. I like strategy games that are single player.
Okay.
Or cooperative ones. Because they make those nowadays, cooperative board games that are strategic. Those can be fun. But it's a certain level for me. Like, it can't be too hard. And this is, like I said, this is in a sweet spot where, like, there's so much to learn and grow. But I never felt like, oh, I'm an idiot. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, it was very, very easy to pick up. But then every time I'm like, I've got this down, there's another twist. I'm like, oh, there's more to figure out. And it's, you do die a whole bunch, but it's super painless in that you just start again. And every time you die, it tallies up certain things and it gives you a certain amount of points. And those points are on a thing. And when you get a certain number, you unlock a new set of cards or a new ability or things like that. So you're always progressing in some form.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's just real fun. I can see, I mean, it's only been like a week or something, but I can see maybe a month or two down the road. I'm just like, yeah, I've done everything I can with this and I'll be done. But for now, I'm enjoying it a lot. So
cool.
I would recommend it. I also do want to talk about a movie real fast. We watched last night. It is not available for free currently, but you can rent it places. We paid $6 on Amazon. It's called The Duke. And here are the salient points about it. It is a piece of historical fiction, aka based on a true story. It is about this old retiree in Northern England who once stole a portrait of the Duke of Wellington out of the British National Gallery.
Mm.
And what hijinks ensued. And the two leads, namely the old guy in question and his wife, are played by Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren. It's a very good movie. I recommend it to people with some caveats.
Okay.
The actual plot of like the theft and the country, like the actual story of the theft and what happens and twists and turns and stuff is fine. It's not spectacular. And there are some places in the second act that I'm like, we really had to do some gymnastics to make this plot point work and things like that. And it's, I would not say it's worth watching for this. It's not a fun like mystery or something like that. What it mostly is a really good slice of life character piece about lower class people living in 1960s Newcastle, England. And it is Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren, so of course they are amazing. And I would watch them just playing characters who were watching TV for the whole run of the movie. And it is sort of a comedy drama in its way. If that sounds appealing, then I would very much recommend it. It's a very sweet movie. It is a very, I would say, uplifting movie. I don't know how accurate it is, but it's a fun story, and it's not a dark story or anything like that. And it is just fun. I enjoy period pieces, especially 20th century period pieces. And I enjoy, British culture. And it also gives a look into what social activism in the socialist country of Britain looks like rather than America, and it is distinct, and there is sort of a component of that in there, so that's fun. But it's very much just a slice of life kind of regular people thing. If that sounds appealing to you, then I highly recommend it. If it doesn't, it might be boring as hell. But I enjoyed it a great deal, and Trish enjoyed it a great deal. But to give you an example, the person I immediately reached out to was my mother. Mm. My mother's going to fucking love this movie. My mother loves certain kinds of movies, and a lot of other people would not necessarily. So, but again, it's called The Duke, and I thought it was quite good and very well acted. To me, this is very funny. It's set in Newcastle. It was filmed in Yorkshire, and those are very different places in my head. But I don't know. I mean, that constantly happens here. Like, it's set in St. Louis, but it's filmed in Astoria, Oregon. I don't know. Somehow in my head, I think it's this thing that I constantly have with Britain where I have a hard time imagining your entire country is smaller than Texas. Because to me, I'm like, Yorkshire is a very specific accent. It's a very specific culture. And Newcastle and Geordie culture is very different. And so to me, I'm like, are people okay with this? That like we're claiming it's here, but I'm like, that's probably it's not a thing.
Pretty stunning how diverse the United Kingdom is given its geographical area.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
I suppose, like you were saying with Texas, there's actually quite a bit of diversity there too, but it's just you just don't think of such a relatively small island set of islands having such incredible diversity in accents and culture and in cuisine even and all this stuff. It's amazing.
And it may just be that we take it for granted here, because I wouldn't bat an eye at it's set in, you know, Southern California, but we filmed it in Illinois. I mean, as long as it looked right, like you obviously could film that in a way that I'm like, that's not what it looks like. But and I didn't do that. I wasn't like, oh my god, that's clearly a Yorkshire countryside. Like, wasn't that. But when you think about it, the culture of rural Illinois versus the culture of Southern California are very different.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't have, I wouldn't even for a second be weirded out by, I think part of it is it involved specifically Screen Yorkshire, like the organization behind getting people to film in Yorkshire. And like, it was emblazoned everywhere. And I just found that so weird. I'm like, but it's set in Newcastle. So in my head, that was just like, because usually when you see that kind of thing, when it's like, you know, oh, Film Canada or whatever, it's set in Canada, when it's, you know, Quebec or Australia, like it's set there. So to me, it was very weird that I'm like, we made a big deal of this being filmed here, but it's not about there at all. So I think that's all in my head, but it was amusing to me. Yeah, that's it. Let's do an email. You know, the theoretical premise.
Okay. Well, this is from Jazz.
Oh, it's going to save and ruin the podcast. She's such a postmodernist.
Oh. She says this is the Yiddish vocab word of the week.
Ooh.
And I don't know how to pronounce it exactly. It's either a shidduk or a shidduk. It's probably shidduk, right? CH is probably pronounced with a K.
I, years ago, I think my family, and I have it somewhere, got me a little paperback, but like thick, but like a standard old timey paperback size, that was a Yiddish lexicon that I treasured. I learned a lot of fun words there.
So she says, a lot of people that I know in their 20s seem to be having trouble meeting a compatible partner despite all the online dating apps. According to a Washington Post article, the number of single people in their 20s who do not have a romantic partner is above 50%, which is the highest number since this measure was first taken in 1986. Of course, not all of them may be looking for a romantic partner, but the high number does seem to suggest something is going on. Why do you think this is? And what do you think might be some alternatives?
All right. We got some serious bait and switch here.
Well, unless, I mean,
must what the apply. Hell's acidic?
I don't know.
I know. This is what I'm saying. Like, you lured us in with some the chance to learn some Yiddish. And then you're like, now let's talk about 20 somethings and their lack of partners.
It's a Jewish arranged marriage.
Oh, is it? Oh.
Yeah. So that's. Wait,
how did you just learn that?
I looked it up.
I didn't you see put, you typing.
When you put, you know, Google has this great thing. When you put a word and definition or meaning after it, it'll actually just pop up an Oxford Dictionary entry. Jewish arranged marriage. Wait, let's see how it's. That's how you pronounce it. Did you hear that? Or is this just in my ear headphones?
No, I didn't hear that, but I heard you.
I should unplug. Here, hold on.
No way this pays
off. Oh, it's not going to do it because. Can you still?
Okay. What I just heard was, can you still hear me?
I'm so sorry.
To what I think you were going to ask, I could, but then I couldn't.
Okay. But you can't.
Now I seem to be able to hear you again.
All right. Well, because unplugging, that was dumb. Anyway.
This is why we have an IT department, and she's right here.
I was trying to get the computer to say how this word is pronounced. I know what
you were trying to do. You were failing.
And I did fail. So what she's getting at is, if young people are failing to meet compatible mates, maybe we just need to go back to this arranged marriage thing.
I mean, on a certain level, I think, okay, get prepared for this, people. A white, almost man is gonna just give his opinion based on no data or personal experience, because I got happily married before I was 30, the end. But I think there's a couple things happening. One of which is I don't like, and one of which I like. First of all, I think the same problem with relationships is happening with the same problem with all the relationships, friendships, acquaintanceships, work relationships, is modern discourse and the modern internet discourse is making it all much more granular and much more sort of difficult because, I don't know, it's just hard. We all get an idea in our head, like, here's a big list of things that every partner needs to have, and we can very easily find out how they tick those boxes right up front and just pass. We can swipe left, as the kids say, if they don't tick those boxes. Like, there's too much. There is shit about Trish I did not ask for. And nowadays, in theory, I might have learned some of those things earlier. And in theory, I might have decided they were deal breakers. Whereas nowadays, I'm like, oh, this is annoying, but I desperately love this woman. So, all right. Which I think is a good thing, because nobody's perfect and you need to adjust. Our relationship, as much as our relationship led to the happy marriage we have now, the first few years of our dating relationship were kind of awful, and I don't know why we stayed together, but I'm glad we did. And here we are. And I think between everybody putting everything about themselves online, and also your dating pool is so much larger now. I literally am friends with somebody online who moved cross country to marry a guy she knew only online, and now they live together and they're married and they have like two kids and the whole deal. Heck, one of our listeners, or possibly former listeners, moved countries to marry a woman who he knew only online, and now they have three kids and he's a citizen here and everything. So I think that changes the game, but I think it makes it trickier to decide if you want to commit to something, I guess. But I also think there's an upside. I think part of what is changing, I think in the modern culture, in the global community, and in the global communication, I think we're doing more questioning about these established traditions. What is marriage? Do we want marriage? What kind of relationship do we want? Does it have anything to do with sex? Is sex something we want to do separate? Is love of, like, in the past, it was supposed to be you get older and you find a person with whom you do the love and you do the sex and you do the companionship and you do the compatible personalities, and that's your life mate, the end. And that's real hard to find. It's also hard to work for, but it's real hard to find out of whole cloth. And I think people nowadays are like, so why does my life partner also have to be my sexual partner, or my only sexual partner? Or why do I have to live with somebody that I love if we aren't compatible living together? Can't we still love each other? I mean, I know married people who have different houses. Admittedly, I think there's a lot of things you got to look at there. But I mean, I think these are institutions that have been assumed for too long. And I like to think this is a sign that people are questioning them and questioning how they want to relate to them. And I think your marriage, your dating, your friends, your lovers, your everything, figure out what you want it to be. And it doesn't have to conform to images of boyfriend, girlfriend, spouse, roommate, whatever. As long as all parties agree that they like the situation, that should be great. And who the fuck cares if you're married or dating or sleeping together or whatever.
Except I think a big problem is that a lot of these people do care. I mean, they're not happy with their situation. They're not just, hey, I just don't care about being married. You know, it's not like that. They want to have romantic relationships. They want to be married, some of these people, and it's just not happening.
Well, so maybe we're in a transitional time, because maybe we're dealing with people who were raised to believe this stuff, and now they're hitting a society that's like, oh, maybe not. And they don't know what to do.
Well, we also have to acknowledge, I think, the reality that even in cultures that didn't arrange marriages, there were still institutions that sort of arranged marriages. And what I mean by that is, if you go back a couple generations, in a given town, was everybody going to church? Probably. Were they meeting their future spouses at church? Probably. Was there a lot of pressure in that church community for them to meet their spouse there and so on? Probably. Also schools, you know, schools, smaller schools, especially small towns and so on. I think we just don't have, I just don't think some of the institutions that were very traditional that are maybe don't exist or that aren't behaving in as traditional a way as they used to are doing that work. And it means that young people have to do it themselves. Well, okay, what does that mean? Where are they going to meet someone? Are they going to meet them at work? Are they going to meet them when they go to college? What if they don't go to college? If
this problem gets, I mean, apply again to all relationship. When you're a grown up, no longer in school, it's a lot harder to find friends.
Sure.
It has to be like your church or your club or your work.
Right. And, you know, some people will meet. It's just, even in my day, it was really unusual for a person to marry their high school sweetheart or whatever, right? Mm. So, you know, how is it going to happen? And people, just about everybody I knew, and a lot of the people I went to high school with, they met someone in college, or they met someone after they started a job somewhere, or after they transferred to a whole other state, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And many of them met their person not really at work, but at church or at some other kind of civic or some other kind of thing that you know, people used to do that they don't really so much do anymore. And when you add to that the economics of our situation today is really making it harder for, you know, people to buy houses at a particular age or feel like they, I mean, here's another thing. If we live in a culture where more people in their 20s are living at home, how free are they going to feel to have a dating life when they can't, you know, they can't take their person home or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe everyone they work with is in that same circumstance, so they can't even find someone who has their own place to take them home to. And so, you know, I don't know, when you put all that stuff together, plus on top of all that, I think there's a lot less social pressure in general on young people to do certain things. Like you were saying, I think, you know, like it used to be, you're 18 and it was pretty reasonable to get married or, you know, to start a family and stuff. And if you, unless you go to college, then you might put it off for a little while, but not everybody went to college. But now, nowadays,
Trish and I thought we waited kind of late. And I was in my late 20s and she was in her early 30s. And nowadays I'm like, we were pretty early to this game.
Yeah, that's right. So these days, it's just, there's not a lot of, you know, a lot of the institutions that used to encourage and help, really, maybe people don't want to think of it that way, but encourage and help that process are gone. And the social pressures, I mean, I think a lot of these kids who want a romantic relationship, they're thinking about kids and marriage and stuff, and they'd like, and maybe they wouldn't want to get married in their 20s, but they at least want to have a steady a significant other or whatever. Yeah, there's just a lot of a lot of the social and cultural supports for that kind of thing aren't there. And like I said, I know if I was in my 20s living at home, I wouldn't even think about dating. I wouldn't even think about it. It's just be like, I can't. It maybe it would be dumb to think that way, but I think that's how I would think of it. And maybe it's just think of get over it. Like, I don't know.
If Trish got hit by a bus tomorrow, why is that always the same? But hit by a bus. But anyway, Trish got hit by a bus, I don't think I would
marry again. I don't even think I would probably date again. And it's not, I'll never love a lover the same way or whatever. I'm just like, seems like a lot of work.
Oh my gosh. I mean,
and that's to find somebody. Also, my marriage has been a lot of work. And the idea of starting that process over again with a new person sounds insane.
Exactly right. I mean, my first marriage was on my 20th birthday. There's a lot of things that I can say about my first marriage.
I love the idea that they just wheeled in a very large present box and you're like, what is this? Happy birthday. Oh my God, it's a bride.
But one thing I was very grateful for the whole time, no matter what else was going on in the marriage, one thing I was grateful for the whole time was I wasn't dating. I loved that. I loved that I was not dating. I was very sad for all of my 20 something friends who had to go through all that dating rigmarole. Oh my gosh. I was so glad I didn't have to do that. And to this day, I do not regret not having a big dating experience in college. I just do not think I would have thought that was enjoyable or at all.
For the novelty of it, I do occasionally feel bad that I didn't ever get to experience Tinder and similar things, because it just seems buck wild. And I'm like, it seems like an adventure. But I wouldn't trade it for what I've
got. I just wouldn't blame kids today for not having a stomach for it, honestly. Yeah. I wouldn't blame them.
Well, to Jazz's point, maybe, I don't know. I'm still confused. I should have read this email. I think you snuck in things and left. I don't know. You're weird. But to Jazz's point here, up until a few years ago, I was fairly opposed to arranged marriages. I have since found the error in my ways. And I think the answer to this, as the answer with so many things, is diversity. There should be institutions maybe specifically for this. Like, you come to me and you fill out a thing and you tell me what you want in a marriage and you tell me what you're like, and I match you up with somebody and y'all get married. You do a 90-day fiance thing and you get married. And people who want that can have that. And then other people who don't want that and want something else. Again, I think giving opportunities for everybody to try and get the kind of relationship they want in the method they want to is not only good, I think it's achievable in a way it never was before. Like, we can have such a plurality of ways. We can create these institutions you're talking about. And we can be much more transparent about that's what they're for and exactly they are for.
I agree. And also I think there's another problem is that not long ago, I mean, in my memory, there were certain rules about how especially heterosexual people got together. And quite frankly, they were awful.
Yep.
They were awful, awful, awful rules. You know, and I could never conform to those rules myself. I'm amazed that I dated as many people as I dated in the end, and that I even have a wife today, because that all of that stuff was just so stupid to me. Now, thank goodness, a lot of those rules have been thrown out the window. Thank goodness. But they haven't really been replaced by anything else, and nor do I think they should be. But I think what needs to happen is people need to realize that it's good that those rules are gone. It's good that they haven't been replaced by anything else. And we can do this without someone telling us how. Now, I think a lot of
options, not rules.
Yeah. I think a lot of young men might be worried, you know, it's like, well, you know, we live in an age where, you know, consent is important. All these things are important and all that's good. But they're afraid. And this is something I can relate to a little bit myself, because when I started dating, even though a lot of my male friends did not care about things like consent or whatever, I did. And it did make dating tricky because, you know, a lot of times when I was dating women, they'd get very frustrated with me not doing certain things that to them would indicate I was interested. But to me indicated being presumptuous and rude. You know what I mean? So
early days of my relationship with Trish, we had some issues that largely, without going into too many details here, largely stemmed from Trish's like, everyone I've ever dated has been like X. Therefore, I assume all guys are like X.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I'm not like X. And she interpreted that to mean something negative about her.
Mm.
And the answer was, no, actually, I'm just not that kind of person. Not all guys are actually like that.
Well, okay. So imagine, you know, you and I going through that kind of thing in dating. I think today that probably everybody's going through that kind of thing. It's like, well, if the rules are thrown out the window, and thank goodness they are, well, how do we do this? What do we
do? How do you define yourself?
Yeah. How do we broach these topics? How do we talk about these things? Now, of course, I think you and I both know, because we've had to do it. You just do it. And it is hard. It is difficult. You have those difficult conversations with the other person, like you were just talking about, but you can do it. But I think maybe a lot of young people, I mostly am thinking of young men, because I think I can relate to that, but probably young women also. It's just, we don't know, because the rules are all different now. We can't learn from the people before us, because they learned from all those dumb rules. So how, and we have to make it out, figure it out ourselves.
Vocal plurality out there touting supposed rules.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
To this day. Yeah. And some of them are the old school rules. If he doesn't pay on the date, he's not worth it. Get rid of him. Or some of them are trying to do new ones. If he presumes he's going to pay, then he's clearly an old fashioned misogynist and you should run away from him. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it has to do with how much money I'll have and what you want to do.
And you do have people who will answer everything I'm saying and say, well, that's why those rules were good, William. I mean, and they come from evolutionary biology, and they'll say all this nonsense. It's not true.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, maybe what's happening here is we're just going through the growing pains of getting rid of an old way of doing things. And so the young people, I mean, who are they going to learn the new way from? Because all of the people they know learned the old way. So
yeah,
they're going to have to, in some ways, figure it out on their own. And that's going to be hard. And,
well, you know, and of course, what we're describing, I think, has happened. All this has happened before and will happen again. I mean, I'm sure, you know, when the railroad became a thing, this was an issue, because sometimes you wouldn't marry somebody in your own town and things like that. I mean, I don't ever want to do the thing of like, nobody else in history has ever dealt with it. Like, this is a different version.
Right.
And I just want to throw this out here. It is a random detail, but we are still living in an era where it's only been about 50 years since no-fault divorce was even legal in this country. Mm. And now it is no longer unusual, but we're still at most two, maybe three generations into dealing with it. So it may be common nowadays, but we're still at a situation where, like, your parents were the first people ever to do that. And the people before that, their parents, it would have been unheard of. And that's a huge, and it's a wonderful thing, because it recognizes that the very institution of marriage is fucked up. And the idea that if you're highly compatible with someone, you're always going to be highly compatible with them is ridiculous, but it's a huge game changer.
Well, yeah, because it makes relationships, like, you know, these monogamous relationships, because that's what we're really talking about.
It makes them
riskier, because there's not some guarantee that they're going to last forever. And also, most kids either have experienced directly or indirectly, by only one degree of separation, parents getting divorced and how awful that can be. So, you know, it's not just risky, that it's a risk that's felt, I think, by, you know, young people in a way that, like, you know, when I was growing up, I knew hardly any adults who were divorced, or kids who, from divorced homes, hardly any. So I didn't even have a concept of what that was like or what that would mean.
There was an old crack video that I think their whole thing was talking about in the 80s and 90s, sitcoms started killing off one parent, usually the mom, and that it was probably because they weren't at the point yet where they were comfortable showing divorce, but divorces were happening in record numbers, and they wanted to show that, like, you can come back from that. And their way of doing it was just to kill him off so it didn't look scandalous or whatever. But in the process, one of the guys, when he figures this out, he's like, yeah, I didn't think the rest of you would notice, you lucky people who didn't have to be a child of divorce like me. And one of them's like, what are you talking about? My parents are divorced. And the one next to him says, yeah, I'm divorced. It's like, yeah. It's not that uncommon anymore, but it's still, societally speaking, a relatively new concept. And it's another one of those striking of a rule.
Yeah.
There was a rule. When you get married, you stay married. And now it's like, no, you don't have to do that. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a loss of rules and, to a degree, an increase in options, which is a good thing, but it's a lot. It's destabilizing.
Yeah. It's going to take time for people to figure out how to adjust, which it's frustrating because while that's happening, you just get a whole bunch of commentators are saying, oh, look at all these young people that aren't getting married and are single and are unhappy. It's too bad all of these rules and institutions are gone. Well, no, that's not.
No,
it's not too bad they're gone. It's just,
and we still want boring ass basic white people who live in a small town and they're straight and everything and find each other in church or whatever and get married and are happy. That's great. I still want you to be able to do that.
And they still do that.
Just you. I want all the people who don't want to do that to not feel like they have to do that. That's all I'm saying. Options, not rules.
I wonder. So again, I'm kind of talking about heterosexual couples. I wonder if it's mostly heterosexual people who are having this problem, or if non-heteronormative people.
No, I. Non-heteronormative people are having a similar issue.
Mm.
And actually, it's why I hate romantic comedies, but I'm really excited about the new movie Bros, partially because I really like Billy Eichner, but it looks hilarious. But from what I have seen, again, not straight, but straight living, white, mostly guy, me, is being told by society or whatever, we're at a point that there was a clandestine and covert nature. There was an established queer culture back in the day. And a lot of it was based out of, you know, you get what you can get and you just have to find somebody because we're all being really quiet about it because we don't want to get in trouble, et cetera, et cetera. And now, although there are still tremendous issues with homophobia and transphobia and all sorts of stuff like that, it is much more mainstream and much more open and honest. So queer people are suddenly finding that their rules, which were based out of clandestine culture and persecution, are gone because they don't have to do that anymore. But then they're like, so what the fuck are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to act like straight people? I don't know that I want to do that. Also, in case you haven't noticed, straight people don't know how they act anymore either.
Yeah, right.
So this idea, like, I mean, just recently, the 90s, the 2000s, there was a wave of queer people being like, things are getting too domestic for me. I don't like this relationship because it feels too much like straight people, and that's not what we're about. And the truth is, it's like, well, now you can be. And for some, that's a great relief. And for others, it's still like, but that's not how it was defined to me when I was getting this identity.
Yeah.
There is an inherent rebelliousness, an inherent persecution in accepting my queer identity. And for you to say, no, you can just get married and adopt kids and have a good time in your little condo, like, goes against who I was told I am. In the same way that it's like, you don't have to be married. You can do what you want. You don't have to have kids. You can sleep around. You can be polyamorous, whatever. Goes against what all of us straight people were told we are when we were growing up.
Well, I mean, I think that speaks to another interesting point, is as the rules change and people can do other things, that means the market changes, right? Like it used to be that it almost didn't matter if you were gay or whatever else, you're on the market. You know, there's this many men on the market, this many women on the market. And even if you're a lesbian, doesn't matter. You're going to marry a guy and you're going to figure that out somehow. Yeah. Well, now the market has to have changed because you're going to have, let's say you're a young man, for example. Okay, so 20 years ago, there were this many women on the market. Okay, well, now it's okay for a woman to be a lesbian, so she's off. It's okay for a woman to decide she doesn't want to get married or she wants to work on her career till she's 35, so she's off. So,
asexuality?
Yeah.
Which is the least recognized at this point, but still a thing. Transgenderism. I know a lot of perfectly happy, very long-term heterosexual relationships out there where in their 40s or 50s, one of them's like, oh shit, I'm not what I thought I was. Yeah. And in some cases, understandably, the other person is like, oh shit, I don't know that I can be married to you then. Like, sorry, I really am heterosexual. And the fact that you are actually me means it doesn't work anymore.
Well, and so this is what I'm saying. The whole market changes. And so now, and it changes in a couple ways. One, there just aren't as many options as there were before for it. Like, let's say you're a heterosexual male or female or whatever, but not just that, but you also don't know, like if you're in your 20s and you meet someone, are they going to still be straight in their 30s? I mean, you know what I'm saying? There's more things that can change.
Absolutely.
There's fewer things that you can absolutely count on, you know, being true in the next 10, 20 years. So I think makes everything more complicated. College
and I came out as like 12 things.
Yeah.
And my parents were largely accepting, but they didn't even hide it particularly well. They thought pretty much all of it was a phase.
Mm.
And guess what? Some of it was, but guess what? Some of it wasn't. And guess what? Some of it ended up going way further than I thought even at that time. Like, you don't know. I was so proud of a teenager I know recently who was struggling with both sexual identity, sexual orientation, and gender identity. I guess that's three things. And recently was talking about it and talking about changes they went through to their parents. And they said, also, I'm 14. Meaning I'm very much aware this shit might change any day now. And I was like, yeah, that's the wisest thing that's ever come out of your mouth.
Well, and so I mean, I think so as an anarchist, I deal with this all the time, right? It's like something happens somewhere where the social order is withdrawn and everybody freaks out. And then someone says, see, that's why we can't have anarchy. Well, no. This social order pushed all this down like a spring. And now that the social order is gone, the spring is going like that. But that the social order is actually causing this problem. It wasn't an answer or solution. It was a cause. And I think we've lived so long.
Restriction can create great stability. It doesn't mean it creates enrichment or fulfillment or
an accurate depiction
of things.
When these clearly good things, at least from a civil rights perspective, are happening, those springs are going to spring, and there's going to be an uncomfortable period after that where things aren't great. And there's going to be a huge temptation to go, oh, I guess we need to put that spring right back because everyone's so miserable. But you just have to remember that, no, that this is happening because this was bad. And now that it's receding, there's going to be some growing pains, there's going to be some people uncertain, there's going to be some things that aren't working out, but people will adjust, people adapt, and what they adapt and adjust into will be better. And we know that because they were pretty miserable before, and that's the whole reason why these rules are going away in the first place. So, man, I don't know, it's difficult.
The last people who should be talking about, like, I think we're speaking truth from power. Like, is that
I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, it's not like
I'm not saying anything we've said is wrong, but I also occasionally am just like, what the fuck are we talking about?
I get why you're saying that, but I mean, there are some, you know, empirical, observable things here that we can that anyone can speak to. It doesn't have to
be. You don't have to embody an experience to sometimes still accurately understand aspects of it. Now, to be fair, it makes it harder. And I happily invite anybody who has a more, who's a little less straight white cis guy. I always have trouble with this because I'm like, I'm actually several not normal things. I'm not a straight white cis guy, but I'm like, functionally though, from a power dynamic, I'm a straight white cis guy.
Yeah.
And anybody else, you know, like the woman who initially sent in this email, disagrees with this or wants to school us on this, I encourage you to do so.
Oh,
because
me too,
if there is one thing William and I don't want to say are best at, but want to be best at, it is being hyper aware of how much we might be wrong.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So we both get off on having it explained to us in a way that we realize we fucked it up. So feel free. And say your own piece on there. Because we want to hear from you. We don't particularly like each other or each other's opinions. We do this specifically so that the rest of you will come in here. We're faking it. We're like straight drunk girls kissing at a bar so the boys will pay attention to us. We want you all to tell us your thoughts on these things.
That is true. We do want that. I don't know about the kissing in a bar thing.
You didn't hang out with enough drunk straight girls.
I guess not.
There's your problem. Got to get out on the market.
My whole problem.
Your whole problem.
I do feel for young people today because we are in such a...
I hate them all.
We are in such a volatile time. And on one hand, it's like you said, on one hand, it's so positive, but I can see how if you're a young person living through it, it might not feel very positive.
The good news is it all becomes moot because within the next 50 years or so, we're all going to die off. So they don't really have to address these issues. So,
okay. Well, you know, there are some people who will say that because of certain projections into the future, a lot of young people might not feel very hopeful, might not feel like, well, how could I bring a child into this world and stuff? I mean, and that probably does impact some people. Although I mean, this has been true in for many decades now. People have felt like the world is about to end and how can I bring a young person, how can I bring a baby into this world? And they do it anyway in fairly large numbers. So, I mean, I think there are probably some people who are feeling that way, but I doubt that's most people. Just doesn't seem to be how
I don't know. I've talked with most people and that's not what they've said. What are we at? Almost 8 billion? Yeah, I've talked with like 6 billion.
Oh, you're almost there.
Yeah, most people.
You can draw all kinds of conclusions based
on that. No, this was back when I had a job. Now I don't get out very much. So 6 billion is kind of going to be the top.
Oh, all right. Well,
because I don't meet people anymore. It's amazing what you can meet doing clerical support for a nonprofit education company. 6 billion people you get to go there. We are over time and I'm sick of your face. So let's wrap this up here. Go to the blog, like I said, themagicaltalkinghead.com, and tell us your thoughts on it. Write in to us, please, themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com. Your emails are what give us our only actual good content. go to aethertheater.com and see all the Williams crazy shit. And go to smashwords.com and get a book called Odd Wings and read it, or at least tell people you read it, because I wrote it. Do that. And tune in next week, which for us will be 2 weeks, but for you will be next week. And in the meantime, get back out on that market.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.